Hey everybody, welcome to the Green Architects Lounge podcast. I'm your host, Chris Breilich.
I'm your host, Phil Kaplan. How are you doing today, Chris?
Fantastic, Phil. It's beautiful outside, so it cheers me up.
Fine, balmy June in Maine, and it took us this long to get above 50 degrees.
Exactly, and now everyone's, you know, we had our windows rolled down. We're Mainers, so our windows, we rolled down our windows, and it's, 40, so.
Right.
And now the sun's up.
Well, speaking of cold climates, someone who actually comes from a colder climate than us, we are very pleased today to have with us Martin Holliday.
Hey, Martin.
Hi, I just drove over from Vermont to lovely Portland and got to see the Atlantic Ocean.
Excellent. And you, how'd you find your drive? Good.
My drive was fine. It was a little mixture. You know, I came through Crawford Notch, which is always a pleasure.
I love Crawford Notch.
And through North Conway and Conway, which is less encouraging, but made it through the stoplights and here I am.
Fantastic. And for those of you who don't know, in fact, those of you who are listening to us from the Green Building Advisor, there's no way you can't know who Martin Holliday is. You find him, he's the senior editor there, or can I say that?
That's what I'm called.
I think that's what you're called. And you're also often a contributor. What's your official title as it relates to Fine Home Building? Or do you have one?
I think I'm a contributing editor.
Contributing editor, fantastic. And you've seen his awesome articles. We're fans of you and happy to be now colleagues. Can we say that?
Yeah,
sure. R&D.
Right. You know, and you know, everyone's favorite blog, musings of an energy nerd.
Right.
If you go on GBA, the one that's continually has got the most comments, that has a lot of contentious conversation and exciting and just great current stuff. It's all because of Martin and,
right.
and the conversations that he's led. So we are very happy to have him with us today. And Chris and I are excited to grill him a little bit.
Exactly, because everyone who finds us from the Green Building Advisor knows you. They don't know you. They know what you write, whatever. So now we're going to break through that fourth wall. I don't know.
Fourth wall.
I'm messing up my...
I'm a journalist finding myself on the other side of the microphone.
Fantastic. This is like interviewing Ted Koppel or something. Anyway, but you come at this from the exact opposite angle. You know, we're working here. We are surrounded. We're on the, the same podcast focused on green architecture. Phil and I, you know, I'll put words in your mouth, but you were probably a kid like me and decided, oh, I want to be an architect. And then you went to school, and then you know, you got out there in the real world, and a lot of reality hit in. You know, so we kind of came at it from an academic point of view, and then got our real world experience. And you probably, am I right in thinking you came from the exact opposite? You were like...
I was a builder.
You were a builder.
I was a builder and a remodeler and I just a hippie builder.
Sweet.
Just,
God bless,
you know,
hippies.
And an old pickup truck, and I used to have even more humble vehicles before I could afford a pickup truck.
Did you have a Volkswagen minibus?
I never had one of those.
No, okay.
Although my parents did.
Okay.
It wasn't a horse and carriage. It wasn't an Amish thing, was it?
But, you know, back in the days before nail guns.
Yeah.
Back in the 1970s.
Yeah.
You know,
nice.
I was always off grid, so you know, even when I bought nice power tools, I couldn't use them at home.
Wow. All right. So, and where'd you grow up before you're in the industry? Where'd you grow up, though?
I grew up in Beirut, Lebanon, where my father was a teacher. He taught theology at a Protestant seminary. American family, but we grew up overseas.
Fantastic. Now, how do you think? And because I know also your bio has, you know, some You get around. You got around in your earlier career and helping out.
I've had the fortune to be able to travel internationally as well as work and volunteer overseas.
Right. And give us a little rundown. Where have you been?
Well, my family, because we grew up in Beirut, we did a lot of camping and hiking all over the Mediterranean, the Eastern Mediterranean. And my parents liked to travel and camp in remote places. So, you know, one summer we... you know, took a ferry from Italy to Sicily and from Sicily to Tunisia, and then we drove across North Africa through Libya to Egypt and took the ferry back home to Beirut. And we camped in Iraq from Baghdad to Mosul one spring. And we always drove through Syria and Turkey, and we, you know, went to the Black Sea and the Aegean. And it was just a great time of year in the 1960s for independent travel because there were no political problems that prevented us from crossing borders in those days, that it was a wonderful childhood that way. And as an adult, I took along with my brother a long trip to Asia.
Nice.
That we saved money for and did the kind of backpacking hippie overland to India thing.
Oh, yeah.
And wow. I ended up working as an English teacher in Korea when I ran out of money and needed to make some money to get home.
Wow.
Sold blood in Taiwan, and you know, I've got worked as a movie extra in India. I got hired by a Bombay company. Yes, and in Hong Kong, I worked as a movie extra too.
You didn't dance in any of those.
So wait, listeners,
no.
Listeners, our Indian listeners, if you have any kind of footage of a young Martin Holloway, what was the name of the movie? What was the name of the movie?
The big movie was Kranti, and Kranti was a big budget Indian movie, and I finally got the video years later and watched it, and I was on the cutting room floor.
No.
They filmed me in a British Army officer's uniform, a heavy wool uniform in the sweating Indian sun. I had to run across, and I actually died on the battlefield, but I never made the final cut.
Oh,
that's sad.
Oh, that's sad. Funny.
But I was in Kranti.
That's too bad. I was really looking forward to seeing it. Did you have the same mustache back then or no?
I did.
All right. So then, finally, what brought you back to the States? Like, how'd you?
Ever since I dropped out of college in 1974, I've lived in the same piece of the woods in the Northeast Kingdom of Vermont in the middle of nowhere. So I've had a stable address in spite of my travels.
Nice.
I went to college, and like a lot of back to the land hippies in the mid 70s, we all decided that, you know, an academic degree was not as important as the real world, and we wanted to do things with our hands. And, you know, I read the Whole Earth Catalog cover to cover. It was inspired by Stuart Brand's view of a transformed world and went out to the woods to do it.
And look at you now. And here you are. And it paid
off.
You
know, eventually, you know, a phone line came up the hill, and they invented the internet, and I was able to work from home and connect myself more with the outside world, and I wasn't so isolated with 4-foot snowdrifts in the middle of nowhere.
But the world started to connect to you. You didn't move.
No, I didn't move.
It's kind of crawling slowly around you.
Pretty soon they're going to be building a skyscraper over your off-the-grid house.
Hopefully that won't happen.
Right.
So you've been all over the place. How's this global perspective of how you were raised? How's it affected you in terms of the stuff that you're covering now?
Well, I suppose the most important thing is I'm aware how those of us in North America are an unusual slice of the socioeconomic spectrum on the planet. And everyone talks about how 20% of the world's population consumes 80% of the world's resources. And that's certainly true, and that's us. Mm-hmm. We are the ones who are consuming everything. And so our energy usage and our material usage is way off the charts in terms of our fair share of the planet's resources. So I keep that in mind.
So you probably feel that more than, say, my wife, you know, who, you know, I'm picking on her because she never listens to this podcast.
You know, but Sheila knows her cell number.
I know. She was going to say, you should listen to this part right here.
It's so. One thing to read it academically, but if you've traveled a lot in rural areas in Asia, and you realize, I mean, many of the places that I visited in Asia were off the grid, have never seen electricity and never will. Most of the world actually is off the grid, and most of Africa and much of Asia did not have telephones until recently, until cell phones made that leap. But people don't have running water. People bring their water in a bucket from somewhere far away. And so when people talk about green in America, it's really hard to say that any of our choices are sustainable, because they're not. To really have a revolution where we equitably distributed the world's resources would change our lifestyle fundamentally.
So basically, we have to change our ways faster than they changed theirs to be more like ours. Wait, help me make sense, Phil.
I am not a wand waver or a solution finder. I mean, if you were to ask me my prediction is the climate is going to warm very quickly for my children's lifetime. The next generation is going to face a dramatic change in climate, and there's almost nothing we can do to stop it. I think if we had true political leadership, we could stop it or come very close to an adequate response, but none of the leaders are doing it.
Yeah.
And therefore, it's a pretty grim future. But I don't think that we're to blame in the sense that you know, I'm still driving an 8-cylinder truck. I try to drive as little as possible, and my next vehicle's not going to be an 8-cylinder truck. But I don't say that I have a green lifestyle because I don't. I don't pretend that I know the answer because I don't. And I know that I'm part of the problem. It's very complicated for those of us who are the high-consuming West, and I'm one of them.
Yeah. I've seen like that bumper sticker. I don't know if you've seen it, where it's like, "What would Jesus drive?" You usually see it on a Prius or something like that. Which, but you know, he's a carpenter, right? So, or he was. So he'd be in a truck, you know. Right? So,
no doubt.
You know, would he figure out a way to? Well, actually, you know, he could probably rig up something even fancier. But you know, with his given his connections, moving on, we don't need to get into religion.
You know, Martin, it's just funny. Just one quick comment. You know, you see, you don't have a green lifestyle, but I mean, you live off the grid.
Yeah.
And you consume very, very little resources. And if we all had the same not so green lifestyle as you, our planet would be in a different shape.
I don't think so. I mean, I've often said that people who are off the grid don't have the most efficient use of energy. I depend on a gas powered generator in the cloudy months of winter.
Mm-hmm.
I burn quite a bit of firewood, certainly a lot of BTUs. It's good that it's firewood as opposed to oil, but it's not like I have a low energy lifestyle. I consume a lot of energy. I think that the lowest energy consumption is people who live without a car in a downtown somewhere where you can walk to do your errands or bicycle, and you have a multifamily apartment with shared walls. So, you know, living in a remote area, my transportation budget is high.
Mm-hmm.
I still fly in an airplane every now and then.
Mm-hmm.
So these are big problems, and I haven't come up with good ways to crank down my carbon budget to where it should be.
So where do you think we all are in terms of, like, you know, here we are all on the path to sustainability, whether we like it or not, because, you know, Mother Nature, I mean, if we agree on that, Mother Nature's going to smack us on the bottom here in a couple decades and, you know, make us be more green. But, I mean, where do you think we are?
Yeah, are we seeing an exponential change now? I mean, it feels like for some of us in the industry, it feels like, boy, things are finally getting going.
Yeah.
Is that an illusion? Are we really losing steam? Are people not getting excited about it? Where are we?
I think we're really talking about global climate change. That's the fundamental challenge of our age and the fundamental thing that green construction should be trying to respond to.
Mm-hmm.
And I think some of the best writers on the issue are Bill McKibben and Elizabeth Colbert of The New Yorker. And we are nowhere near coming up with a response that is in any way proportional to the challenge we face. So we're falling flat on our face. We're not doing it. And the greenest house that I've ever built and that you've ever designed is nowhere near an adequate response to what we're facing. And that's just a fact.
Hmm.
And as if you look at the country as a whole, what is our transportation budget? What are our transportation solutions? What is the average residential built new building going up, consuming? What are our building codes? How about our commercial buildings and schools? They're woefully badly designed and badly built.
And it would take time to reverse or change.
And 50% of our electricity still comes from coal.
Right. And other countries, you know, doom and gloom.
Right.
But the good news, though, is, you know, guys like you and maybe me and Phil is like we're in the nosediving plane, but we're yanking up on the stick at least. You know, we're trying to level this sucker off until we'll survive the crash when it hits, and we can build another plane and get back in the air as opposed to where we're going now. I mean, right? I mean, it's not going to be like Waterworld where we just, you know, turn into, you know, never mind. I'm going to tangent us off this podcast, so Phil, save me.
Yeah, well, okay, so I'm going to change gears a little bit.
All right,
Martin, we have some bad news for you. Since you've driven down to visit us in Maine, your house has been destroyed in Vermont. I'm really sorry to tell you.
Gasp.
We had nothing to do with it, as far as you know.
Right.
But the good news is we've gotten a large insurance check for you.
Huge.
$500,000. Yes. That's a lot. I don't know if it's too much. You tell us.
Right, right.
So,
someone's
putting
you
on the spot, what are you going to do with that $500,000? What is Martin Holliday's next house going to look like?
You have carte blanche. Here you are where like a lot of people are, where they're, well, yeah.
I got a big fat check. I can spend it any way I want.
That's right. But you have no house.
What is a new house? What does a new house look like?
Exactly. Right? Now that you know now, you're a much wiser Martin Holiday than you were way back. I mean, I'm hoping. I mean, each year we're supposed to be wiser. Otherwise, this gray hair is, you know, what's the point?
All for naught.
Right. So, what do you say?
Well, I guess I would follow the advice I usually give, which is, you know, you want to build as small as possible.
Mm-hmm.
You want to have a really good envelope.
Yes.
And a very low energy budget for your house.
Yes.
And then I take the $300,000 I didn't spend. Yeah. And I use that so that I can retire early or work a little less, right?
Nice.
We were guessing how much extra $100,000 was between two or three that you weren't going to use.
And we said, let's give him five. Make him say he's going to give it back or give it to charity or retire.
He retired. He retired. He didn't give it to charity.
I didn't give it to charity. Oh, it was a trick question.
It was a little. But so 200, I don't know that you get off that easy, though. So.
Exactly, because now it's like, yeah, but you're Mr. Technical whatever. You've got a comment for just about anything someone posts on that blog. You've got backup. You know, you come off, you know what you want to do. So it's like, you know, you've probably percolated on, you know, do you have a preconceived, here's my approach. Well, here's part two of the question. Would you hire an architect, or do you know enough? I know. I mean, it's a serious thing. Because I mean, wow. Really, it's like, for most people, you know, a new house is a shopping exercise. You know, and probably for 3% of the public, you know, they'll actually decide, you know, well, I'm gonna build and design my own house because I'm sick of living in either a big vinyl box or somebody else's old house or something like that. And then a certain percentage of those actually hire an architect. Otherwise, right. You know, a good chunk of those hire. Yeah. Those. And then even a slimmer 10%. Percent actually hire a landscape architect. Sorry, guys. Landscape architects.
Well, I think you probably know that most American homes are not designed by architects.
Right.
Architects are involved with a very small minority of residential projects. If I were building a house, I would probably not use an architect, but I've thought about houses a lot. I think that the average American with a $500,000 check on their kitchen table would probably hire an architect because they've got $500,000.
And they probably don't know as much as you do. But
you know what? Every house has to be designed.
Yes.
And what you want is a good designer. And whether that designer is a builder who knows what they're doing or a design build firm or an architect, you can get a good one or a bad one.
Yeah.
And the trouble with... We could talk about architecture schools and I could interview you. Both of you presumably graduated from architecture school.
Presumably.
Did you guys get a good building science education in your architecture school?
No. I mean, you know, I think relative to other schools, it was good. But I think architecture schools in general, I mean, but we're of the generation, you know, I graduated in 94. Phil, when did you?
Yeah, I graduated in 91.
91. So, like, we were, like, my class was, like, the first class that was in that school that was really starting to get into... it felt that way, you know, like the green side of things. But we did have like a technical building, but it was more like how stuff goes together, and here's how.
Right, and methods. We talked
exactly. It wasn't
some about mechanical systems and whole building systems, but
we had a couple of special classes with a guest who came in about, you know, some.
The danger is that someone can go and hand a big chunk of that $500,000 check to an architect and end up choosing an architect who doesn't necessarily know. How to design a wall, or how, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong.
No, that's true.
And the same is true of builders. You can get a builder who builds a brand new house and doesn't build a wall.
He may have a whole subdivision of
right. Houses. Yeah, coming, you know, so architect, I say you get a good builder before you get a bad architect any day. Yeah,
the certificate on the wall doesn't really tell you much. What you really want to do is interview whatever professionals you're working with and hope that they know, have some answers to your questions and you're an educated homeowner.
Right. But a guy like you, back to the original question, I mean, you're probably going to go at, I mean, because I think what a lot of, when we were thinking of asking that question, we were thinking you're going to say, I'd use a X, you know, heating system. I'd probably look at a Larson Truss double stud, whatever, or a SIPS or something like that. Are there things that are like right off? No, maybe.
Specific. Are there specific?
Well, the specifics, whatever specifics I come up with are only specific to my climate. So that's number
exactly.
one.
And exactly.
So I think, you know, there is a kind of a consensus among people building very super insulated, well-built houses in northern New England.
Yeah.
We're tending to see if people care about this stuff that they're getting, you know, R20 basement walls, all 40, R40 above grade walls, R60 roofs, and triple glazed windows. And many of them are getting an air source heat pump from Asia, one of the new mini splits for heating. Mm-hmm. That's not the only way to build a house, but more and more people are going that direction.
But that's your house.
Right.
No, my house is a hippie house put together with sawmill lumber and logs I cut down on my land and fieldstone I gathered in a wheelbarrow.
But would you do that again? Would you just?
No, I wouldn't. I mean, if I had that check.
Yeah. Yes.
And I hadn't been shamed into admitting that I forgot about the charity obligations of my spiritual life, I'd have to rethink the answer. After I'd tithed and then double tithed.
Yeah, yeah.
And if I were hiring out the work and could afford, I don't know. But yes, I would like to see a better envelope than I have on my 1980 hippie house.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, we're wrapping up, you know, this part one. Part two, we're going to talk about, you know, we call them, Phil and I started calling them sprout follies, the newly green, those who are new to getting involved in all this stuff.
Sprouts. You coined that, Chris.
I did. Yeah. Sure. Chris Broiley. Sprouts. We call them sprouts.
You were sprouting yourself.
Exactly. It's an optimistic phrase. It's condescending because it's like you are greener than they are, but it's optimistic, and that soon they will be green just like the rest of us. So, sprouts. But before we do, Phil, you have any last questions?
Well,
because we have a slew.
I sort of want to know, what's the next big thing in green, in the world of green construction? Mark, what do you see coming around the corner? Is it, you know, people interested in the Living Building Challenge? Or is toxicity a thing? Is passive house really going to take off in this country? Or what else is there? Passive survivability? What are the next big words?
I don't know. It's hard to predict. I think that I've said this several times, the basic super insulated approach was nailed down in the mid-1980s. Mm-hmm. But it still hasn't been integrated into normal residential construction practice in America. So I keep telling people, when we've learned all of the lessons of 1985 and implemented them, we can see if there's something new. So I think what we really need to do is educate builders and designers into basic air sealing techniques. I mean, getting the basics down, which we're still not doing. I don't see any whiz-bang technological inventions, and I'm very bad at predicting trends. I think the only thing that will change people's attitudes is a doubling or tripling of energy costs, which is quite possible, although I've said that for years and been wrong most of the time. But if and when energy prices take another huge leap, that will change residential construction in America very quickly. But that's about all I've got for predictions.
Yeah.
Okay. Final question. How much better is Maine than Vermont?
Well, you've got the ocean.
Yeah, that's right.
That's about the, but you've also got more traffic and more tourists.
Yeah, that's true.
So is it worth it to look out over the ocean and have to wait for the traffic at the traffic light?
You're damn right it is. Okay, so that's going to wrap it up for part one. You can reach us at galounge@greenbuildingadvisor.com. Also check out our Facebook page. Sheila shamed Phil and I in a conversation about showing us how lame our Facebook page was. And Phil's like, Phil's like, oh, we've got a Facebook page.
I did say that, didn't I?
Yes, you did. And so now we promise to be better at that if you visit us there. But of course, Green Building Advisors is the best place to leave comments of a technical nature and all that. So.
Okay, stay tuned for part two with Martin.
Yeah.
Thanks for joining us, Martin.
Thank you.
All right, take care, everybody.
That's it for this part of the episode. Be sure to tune in next week for more from the Green Architects Lounge podcast. A quick reminder that our theme music is Zelda's theme from Perez Prado, and that the views and drinking habits of the hosts do not necessarily reflect those of the Green Building Advisor. Thanks for tuning in, everyone, and keep up the good work.